I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. We talked a little bit last week about the Arab Spring going sour, and at the end of it, we started picking up a conversation about Iraq and what was happening there. 2 weeks have passed. What I like to do, Jim, is one of the questions that keeps coming up is status of forces, that we did not get a status of forces agreement in place. Was it even possible to get one in place? Because that seems what has led up to all of this.
Yes, it was, but it became a political football in Iraq. That all the problems were America's fault, not Iraqi fault, and that the Americans were criminals. You know, it sounds like Saddam Hussein is still there, you know, grinding out his propaganda. And that's stole. I mean, this is the Middle East we're talking about, you know, so that is not all that unusual, you know, that sort of, you know, pretzel mentality. And although a lot of people in the Iraqi military and the government, you know, pointed out the obvious that the Iraqi military and security forces needed the Americans, not so much for combat troops, but for intelligence and logistical support. You know, very basic stuff. As the old saying goes, amateurs study tactics, professionals study logistics. Well, the professionals in the Iraqi military and government understood that it was insane, you know, to chase the Americans out and try and continue rebuilding alone a workable Iraqi logistics system. Now, the other thing that you have to be careful about as an Iraqi talking about is corruption. It was basically a steal-a-thon. Everybody was there in a position of power to get rich, basically. You know, the crooks vastly outnumbered, you know, the honest people. And, you know, the stealing was often to the detriment of the security forces. For example, stealing pay of troops and police. Now, when the United States was there, we put controls in place where we could detect that. And then, you know, at the senior level, the ambassador or whatever, we could, you know, make credible threats to the Iraqi government. Look, pay the damn troops or, you know, whatever. You know, basically go to the UN, do this, do that, publicize, you know, the dirty little secret of Iraq. That sort of worked. But that all went away when the Americans went away. The embassy was still there. They could still make threats, but they didn't have the information. They didn't have the advisors who were assigned to every unit who could. There were basically Americans, often special forces guys who spoke the language. You could just go around and say, hey, you get paid this month? And you know, the average Iraqi guy who hadn't been paid in 2 months would say, hell no, you know, and they'd give you details. We weren't getting that anymore, or at least not to the extent we were getting before, not sufficiently to hold it in check. So basically, money for fuel was stolen, ammunition was sold off to the black market or sometimes terrorists. There were a few arrests for that when there was a particularly heinous attack on civilians. But basically, you know, security became an opportunity to steal, not a duty, you know, to protect the Iraqi people. And now it's caught up with them. So status of forces is only on the table again and basically been delivered, so they say. I mean, there are conflicting reports about that because their backs are against the wall. I mean, basically, it begins to dawn about half the Iraqi army has disappeared. In other words, you know, the people in the military have just been dispirited. And it's not an overnight thing. It's been going on for 3 years. It's getting worse and worse and worse. And a lot of the soldiers are not basically, you know, running for the hills. Well, there aren't many hills, and that's where the Kurds are. You don't want to go there. They don't welcome the Arabs. They're basically going home and joining the local militia, often taking their weapons and uniforms with them. So it's going to be the long-feared civil war. There's never really been a civil war, but this civil war is going to be particularly nasty. And Iraq, apparently, Iran has made a deal with Maliki and his crew to basically save his bacon in return for, well, basically Iran takes control of Iraq. And that can get really ugly because the Iranians have always wanted to do that. They consider southern Iraq to be basically a part of Iran, if only because that's where the most holy shrines of Shiaism are. And they feel that they should not only be the protectors of the Shia shrines, but also the Sunni shrines, namely Mecca and Medina. So that's getting Saudi Arabia upset. Now, I've spoken to people from over there, and they tell me with great seriousness, people who are not whack-a-moles, that the Saudis have nuclear weapons. Allegedly, they bought three of them from Pakistan. Whether that's true or not, the Saudis will now have their backs up against the wall if there seems to be a threat of Iran taking the southern part of Iraq, where most of the oil is. And, of course, in the north, the Kurds are on their way to taking the northern fields, which account for about a third of the oil, and they are already making deals with the Turks to get that oil out. Turks will take a cut and basically go merrily along, just dispensing with the Arabs completely. So it's not going to be the same after all this is over, and there's no way of telling exactly how things are going to play out until the proverbial dust has settled.
Now, Austin, you wrote an article this week in your syndicated column that talked about maybe it's even before the status of forces that this all started, that we could go all the way back to World War One, and that we're still seeing the fallout from World War One on this.
Well, Dan, I've done that. I columns looking at World War One as the extraordinary historical transition. That it is the troubles that led up to World War One and the great conflagration. Some of them had been evident for 300 or 400 years, and here I'm something of a Balkanist, and even though I don't speak and read Turkish, a little bit of an Ottomanist. What happens with Strategy Page and the and some of the historian gamers around, if the, Jim's old company, Simulations Publications, that we get to be knowledgeable a lot of, or know a little bit, just enough to be dangerous about certain historical eras and root causes of conflicts in World War One and World War Two, in particular. But some of the problems that you could see 3 or 4 centuries earlier, as problems within the Ottoman Empire, certainly 70, 80 years of problems with the Habsburg Empire, and that's the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The Romanovs, Peter the Great and Catherine the Great, expanded their empire. That's the Russian Empire, but the attempts to modernize it were very inadequate, and that's a mild way of putting it. So you had three decaying or institutionally weak major European powers, great powers was the term of the time, meeting in the Balkans. And you've also got France and Germany still locked up over Alsace and Lorraine and the Franco-Prussian War, resentment on grievances on the French side. And then there's the British with their fleets and cousin Willie and the Germans' empire, jealous of their British cousins' naval power. That often gets more attention, I think, than it should as a root cause of World War One. But there's colonial competition, and to translate that into 21st century terms, that's a form of global competition, globalization. So I've written about these themes numerous times. The Ataturk book that I did for Macmillan explores some of these issues in the lead into World War One and the World War One chapters. But to get to the column this week, you say maybe World War One isn't over. No, and some of the issues going on in the old Ottoman provinces, their vilayets, still plague us. As a commoner, actually read the individual read the column on strategy page, sent me an email through my creator syndicate box saying, Colonel Bay, I agree with this. I've thought this myself for a long time, but you know, a lot of the violence that you're referring to, at least in the Middle East now, seems to be more Arab on Arab. As a matter of fact, I got that comment from another off of another listserv as well. And you go back and look at the disruption, some of the disruptions the Ottomans faced. It was Arab intra-Arab fighting was something that the Ottoman army would go and try to put down during the 18th and 19th centuries. There was plenty of oppression coming from the Turks on the Arabs. So the Arab gripes about the Turkish maladministration, Ottoman maladministration, are absolutely overwhelmingly legitimate. But there were plenty of Arab versus Arab struggles that at times the people caught in the crossfire were glad to see the Turks show up and, I'll use the term, modern term, Bigfoot it, be the colonial power and put down the fighting. So if I point out that there's Arab Shia versus, in this case, the sectarian divide that Jim is referring to, Sunnis and Shias in Iraq, that's something that was going on and is still going on since really 680 AD when the Battle of Karbala. And Hussein was killed. Those who favored Ali's line, the son-in-law of Muhammad, the Shias, and Sunnis split. So my take on this is some of what happens in World War I, Dan, is that what changes is you lose three of the great, actually you lose four empires, the German Empire, such as it is, falls as well. European colonialism is damaged and beyond repair. And self-determination, as in Wilsonian principles, I'm not using them as a codification of self-determination, but the idea of it, that you're going to be responsible for yourself, figure out how your own self in some shape, form, or fashion. And look, there are going to be plenty of people who will disagree with this, but I'm looking at the kernel, the core of what self-determination is. You're going to be asked or have some say about where you are located in a political entity, your place in a political entity. And you also have, going along with that, with World War I is a huge advance, Dan, in high-speed communications. We already had the telegraph and telephone, but a global conflict like that with powers involving opponents with high technology capabilities is a huge push on technology. The airplane advances, aeronautical engineering advances rapidly, telephonic communication, wireless communication. Now everybody, you don't have cell phones, so that everybody isn't their own telegrapher, which is a comment I make in that that column. That's where we are now, but now you can hear these voices. The self-determined, or would-be self-determined, get to join the chit-chat, where particularly in the Ottoman lands, they were silenced because the Turks they didn't have the rail system or the telegraph system, and the Sultan was very suspicious of them for just that reason, because they might be his subjects. They weren't citizens, they're subjects. Remember, it's an empire. Might be influenced by radical ideas from Paris or London. That same kind of attempt at isolation goes on today. You see it in North Korea. North Korea, it's a losing proposition now in the age of the cell phone, but that certainly is at play. So that was the gist of the column that you're referring to. I'm glad to. It does have relevance to what's going on in Iraq, but you want to get back to Iraq now and maybe pick up on the SOFA agreement or some of the other things that Jim said?
Yeah, why don't you comment on that?
Let's just kick off with Jim's lead on it, that you know the professionals look at logistics. Remember that personnel is part of logistics, because people are part of the pipeline. And when you had U.S. advisors, logistical advisors and communication advisors, there's involved in bean counting, and bean counting is a logistical mechanism for suppressing, if not eliminating, corruption. And if you have some input on personnel, then you can favor the less corrupt or the non-corrupt over the corrupt. And that's also an element of what Jim was talking about when you had the U.S. advisor capacity. Look, it's known that I've written three or four pieces for the Wall Street Journal with an Iraqi journalist by the name of Omar al-Nadawi. I mean, you can look it up on the web, but I've got good contacts in Iraq beyond Omar. And while the negotiations were going on in 2011, consistently, I shared this with Jim at the time. Consistently was, look, basically everybody, even in Maliki's group or in Iyad Alawi's Iraqi list, know that they need the Americans. They want the U.S. to, and I'll go back to the word, bigfoot it, come in and say, I'm sorry, we need to do this, and we would, you know, act like we get to be the bad guys to do the right thing. And the current administration didn't do it. Now, that's taken as criticism of the one critical way of reading the situation, but that's what I was being told while it was going on. And as Jim said, there was all this internal bickering going on in Iraq because nobody wanted to. This is a leadership failure on the Iraqis' part. Step out and say, hey, we need the Americans, because they'd be capitulating to the outside power. And yet it was in everyone's interest to maintain that personnel and logistics and advisory and communication overwatch. And in order to protect that element, I mean, U.S. wanted 20,000 troops. I think that was the 15 to 20,000. I did a back of the envelope look at what kind of residual force we needed, and I came up with about 15,000, essentially three brigade combat teams, because you needed to be able to defend bases and have a strike force of sufficient capacity to protect the American advisory personnel. And I think that would have done it, but we didn't do it.
Jim, right now we've got at least three major factions fighting. Is there other? We've got the Kurds, we've got the Sunni, and we have the Shia. But the Shia outnumber both of these groups, correct?
The Shia are about 60% of the population. The Sunnis are 20, probably less, because a lot of them are still in exile. The Kurds are about 20%. The Sunnis are outnumbered by more than 4-1 in terms of population.
And how is that going to affect things as things move forward?
Well, the Sunni, first of all, you got to understand that a lot of the Sunni believe that it is their God-given, literally, right to rule Iraq, even though they are a minority. Although some of them will insist with a straight face that they're actually a majority, but there's no numbers, either, you know, a census or a, you know, you can do analysis with satellites and what have you. There's various statistical tools that basically confirm, you know, the that 60-20-20 number. But the Sunnis believe that they should rule, and the more desperate or the more ruthless of them, you know, not just the ISIL, who are basically Islamic fundamentalists, but also the Ba'ath Party, which is still around. They're more secular. Sunni nationalists, again, more secular. The big divide within the Sunni community is, once we do restore Sunni rule, will it be a religious dictatorship or a secular dictatorship? So what you're seeing now is only phase one of the Sunni plan for conquest. there's a Sunni civil war after the, you know, the war to put the Sunnis back on top. So you can see where this is all going. Nowhere. The Sunnis are united, however, despite these religious and, you know, political differences, because they lost all their money when Saddam was overthrown. When Saddam was in power, it's something like 80% of the money, the oil money, which was the primary income for the government, and a large chunk of the GDP. I mean, the country was prosperous without oil, but it was very prosperous potentially with oil. 20% of the population was basically getting most of the 80%. And suddenly overnight, that disappears. That impacts everyone. Everyone who's a Sunni is feeling this. All of a sudden, you know, criminal behavior, religious fanaticism, it all becomes justified because, hey, we're broke, we're out of a job. Not only is it our patriotic duty, our God-given duty, but our economic duty to get the damn oil back. And that's what they're basically fighting over. I mean, a lot of them. I mean, there are some true believers in the religious camp, but they're not the majority. For most Sunnis, it's a very practical reason for getting back in control. Now, when we left in 2011, we basically had shown the Shia that by brokering a deal where we basically, a full employment, you know, arrangement for a lot of the young Sunni men with guns. That's how we broke the back of the, you know, the Al-Qaeda and its various, you know, terrorist organizations. We took away the financial incentive. So you can see how important that is. But as soon as we left, the Shia, who basically have bitter memories of Sunni rule, which got particularly bitter, you know, after the failed invasion of Kuwait in 1991, there was a Shia rebellion, which was put down very brutally. And Saddam continued the reign of terror. I mean, it was literally terror. His policy was to hire a lot of criminal gangs, basically give them license to kill, as long as they terrorized Shia. They could rob from the Shia. It was almost, you know, futile, in the way it was done. But they were encouraged basically to do this, openly in the street, as it were. So all other Shia could see, hey, I'm cutting this guy's tongue out because he says something bad about Saddam or about the Sunnis and what have you. There were rapes, there were disappearances and what have you. Bad stuff. The Shia, remember. And as soon as the Americans were gone, they started, because they had the elections, the Shias were elected, they were the majority, they controlled the government, and they said, why should we pay anything to these damn Sunnis? They've been nothing but trouble. Yeah, the trouble is, as the old saying goes, you know, if you're going to take someone down, take them all the way down. Don't leave them wounded. They basically just cut the payroll off. They cut, you know, they didn't hire any more Sunnis. Suddenly, the Sunnis were impoverished again, and all of a sudden, the what was left of the Islamic radicals had a lot of recruits, a lot of people saying, "Hey, I want to come back." You know, these Shia, they screwed us. The Americans are gone. And you can't trust the Shia, and so you can see where that's all going. And this is where it's gone. The advantage that the Sunnis have is that they are not just willing to kill, they're willing to die. You know, when you're using Islamic fanaticism, that gives you a big edge. They feel they have nothing to lose. So until they get it all, until they get control of the oil money, now it's not enough to get control of the oil fields and what have you, they have to be able to sell the oil. Now they're not going to be able to do that. We're not going to basically do business with Islamic terrorists or basically an outlaw regime, as it were. That's pretty much a non-starter. But that's what they believe. They believe that we already robbed a bunch of banks in Mosul. We got hundreds of millions of dollars in cash. There's all that oil. You know, the promised days are almost here. Let's keep going. Let's keep killing. The Shia are running away from us. They have resisted. They have been fights. It's lasted, you know, a week or more, but eventually the Sunni won. So they feel they're on a roll and that victory is there. They just got to keep at it. And that's what we're up against. As Austin pointed out, you know, the Maliki came to America and said, hey, come back in here with the big foot, you know, make it all better. And, you know, our policies basically said, well, screw you. You know, unless you basically, you know, agree to make some fundamental reforms, what's the point? We put you back into the catbird seat and the cycle starts all over again. as a democracy, you can't put up with that. I mean, it doesn't make the immigrants in the United States, if there was a Republican or a Democrat, you're running in the White House, that the problem would still be the same. And of course, that's one of the amusing aspects of American politics. You know, Democrats and Republicans paint the world, especially foreign affairs, as a totally different worlds. But when whoever gets in power, they find themselves reaching for the same solutions, because basically there is no Republican world or Democratic world. It's all the same shitty world as far as, you know, the way some people regard the United States. And that's what you got to deal with over in the Middle East. So our problem is that Maliki is still not, as people are saying now, some pundits are saying now, quite accurate, I think, Maliki is willing to take the whole country down with him because he's not getting his way. A petulant child, as it were. Now, there are divisions within the Shia world. There are, last week, several senior Shia clergymen came out and denounced Maliki, said, you know, you're bad for the government, we need somebody else. But Maliki has allies. He basically has very wealthy thieves who are in high positions, and he's saying, look, guys, you know, if we lose this, we become, you know how the UN is about war criminals, and, you know, I mean, my God, the international banks are revealing, you know, who owns, secret bank accounts or what have you. We either got to win this, you know, semi-legitimately, or we're doomed. We lose all our money. Some of us go to jail. Some of us get killed. So basically, like the old saying goes, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. We've made it so difficult for, kleptomaniac terror, tyrants, to not get away with their stolen money, that they basically have no choice but to stand and fight. So Maliki and his crew are saying, you know, nope, it's got to be our way or hell's highway. And that's where this is basically heading. And there's a lot of jumping through hoops, you know, the diplomats saying, well, we can offer you this, maybe special deal, immunity, whatever. But we've seen this happen before. And, of course, the Iraqi leadership pays attention to what's been happening to wealthy but corrupt tyrants in the last 10 years. It's not good. Well, it's good and it's not good, depending on how you're looking at it. And they basically see no reason to cooperate unless it's definitely in their interest. So what we're talking about now is working out a deal which rewards the crooks who caused the problem, so they will allow a solution to fix the problem.
Dan, let me comment on a couple of things that Jim said. I was talking about 2011 when I said, you know, that the U.S. needed to Bigfoot it, and the current administration didn't. But Jim is relating to 2014, which is our situation now is, I think, and Jim sums it quite well. And as he also says, there are a lot of other commentators, some of them actually informed, Dan, that agree that, unless you reform Prime Minister Maliki, what the heck? Why should we do anything? Because this is a divergence of interests in 2014, where in 2011 you had common interests and everyone dithered and fiddled. It was a mutual leadership failure in Baghdad and Washington in 2011. I agree that Maliki is now definitely part of the problem, but the Ayatollah, Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani, as Jim mentioned, I'm just going to mention him by name. He wasn't the only senior Shia leader that said that needed reform, but give Sistani credit. That guy's been pushing for reform for over a decade. I remember clearly a statement he made, I want to say it was late July, early August of 2004 when I was in Iraq, plus one of the conduits of information from Sistani was as I recall, it was one of his sons-in-laws. He had at the time his two spokesmen were a nephew and a son-in-law. So it was one of them, but it was frequently in contact with British troops there in Iraq, and you'd see the comments that the spokesman was making, and it was, you know, it was like, we know fundamental reform includes we've got to have an honest government. And at the time, what was coming from the Grand Ayatollah was directed at Iyad al-Alawi, who was the interim prime minister, and he's also head of the Iraqi List, which is the largest opposition party in Iraq right now. And you know, Alawi is a multi millionaire. There are questions about his own background, but his orientation as a political leader was, I'm going to deal with the corruption. And he's a Shia, and that's one of the things that Alawi over the last 4 or 5 years, remember in the last election, not the ongoing one, but the earlier election, the Iraqi List won a plurality of votes. They won more than Maliki's Shia coalition. And Alawi has been after Maliki about corruption and cronyism. And he's got a number of Sunnis in his party. He also has actual Iraqi liberals, and there's some Kurds in the Iraqi List. I think we'd be better off. Iraq would be better off, and U.S. interests better served. Of course, that'll kill him in Iraq for to hear an American say that if Iyad al-Alawi were prime minister. But we're not going to see that. Where the Maliki's choice is, as Jim described, it's the hard choice. And Jim also gave some of the background on why the Shias are so fearful. I think I will make a comment about this. In 91, I wrote a column for the Houston Chronicle, and a similar column in early 92, where I said that I thought the George H.W. Bush administration's decision, the coalition decision not to go on to Baghdad, was a marker that said we're going to live up to exactly what we said we were going to do, and we're not behaving as a great power making a decision and going and knocking off Saddam, because the way that coalition was organized was not to knock off Saddam. So we stopped. We stopped really at the Euphrates, even though the French 6th Light Armored Division said that they had recon elements in southern Baghdad. Probably true. That was out there when the left flank, the French were covering the left flank of the Desert Storm operation. But we stopped. And part of the Republican Guard got away. And there's all kinds of conspiracy theories and not so conspiratorial theories about that. But we stopped. And then what happened when Jim alluded to it. The Shia say 150,000 of us were slaughtered. You look at the mass graves and body count, well, probably somewhere 100,000, but could be 150,000. And we sat there, and that happened. So what I'm saying is that when I became aware of what those losses were, and this is 92, 93, I thought, you know, that was a mistake. We should have gone on, and we didn't do it. And my assessment at the time is that, well, I was wrong. And that became the kernel of the last novel I had published, Dan, Wrong Side of Brightness. It actually begins with in the last phases of Desert Storm and the mass murder of Shias in southern Iraq. Now, I'll finish the personal story here. I had paperback copy published in paperback, and I had it in 2004 there in Iraq. I had a couple of copies with me, and one of our Arab translators, who was actually a naturalized U.S. citizen and basically grew up in Michigan, came up and said, "Hey, Colonel Bay, I see one of the guys on the staff has got two or three people actually have copies of your novel. I'd like to read it." And I said, "Here, let me give you one." I gave him a paperback. And a couple of weeks later, he came up to me and he says, "Well, I read it. Now, this is fun to read, but it starts off with Iraq." And this, I said, yeah, it does, doesn't it? And he says, "You know, I have family in southern Iraq," because he was Shia. And he said, "Yeah." I said, you told me that. And he says, it was awful. He says, just like it was described. And I said, "Well, let me tell you about my own thinking about what I thought in 91 and what I think now." I said, "One of the problems we're running into here in 2004 is distrust among Shia Arabs, you know, you see us, you know, Shia citizens of Iraq, you see the liberating element of this war, toppling Saddam, but we sat there and you guys got murdered. And he says, that's how blunt it was. He says, I wasn't there. I was in the U.S. But, you know, that's because I was lucky. And I said, well, so I'm giving you this personal dimension there, Dan, just to see what when Jim says that this has political impact, it's still got political impact. Huge.
Now,
something to remember with that. I'll never forget. I was on the Today Show doing, you know, the end of the 91 war, giving sort of a wrap up. And I think it was Katie Couric. She asked me the question, well, why didn't we go to Baghdad? And I said, well, it's very simple. We made a deal with the Saudis.
Yeah.
They would let us come in to defend them, and they would basically take care of the wackos. And they had, remember, that's where, you know, the modern version of Islamic terrorism comes from, Saudi Arabia. Religious fanaticism, you know, is us. And they said, but you must not attack Iraq because Iraq defends us, i.e. Saudi Arabia and all the other Arabs in the Arabian Peninsula, from Iran. And they of course, the Iraqis had just done that during the 1980s, that when, you know, Saddam Authority can invade, you know, Iraq and steal some oil. And they basically, the Iraqis paid a heavy price, as did, you know, the Arab countries that exactly financed most of it. But all the dead were basically Iraqis. So basically, you know, our diplomats and senior military people said face to face with the senior Saudi people, all right, we promise we won't go to Baghdad. Now, so you can see the problem. Yes, we could have gone, broken our word. You know, hindsight is wonderful. But at the time, it seemed like a bad idea.
Yeah.
To lie to the Saudis about that solemn promise. Because, again, yeah. Now, again, hindsight is great, but let's keep in mind other things that were going on at the time. The Saudis said, we can take care of Saddam. And they tried. There was about one or two, you know, assassination attempts on Saddam, you know, throughout the 90s. But Saddam was a lot more than the Saudis bargained for. And he was, of course, I pointed out at the time, you know, usually on TV, so there are plenty of witnesses, that even if you kill Saddam, there are plenty of Saddam wannabes to replace him. You know, Saddam, you know, clones, as it were. Because what you're talking about is not Saddam Hussein's regime. You're talking about the Sunni regime, the minority regime in Iraq. That is not going to disappear short of, you know, some very severe measures. And the British learned, and I also pointed out in the past, that this is nothing new. In 1940, during the early days of World War II, the British had by then pulled out. They created Iraq and they pulled out. They left the Sunnis in charge because they understood, you know, how it worked. We know you're the minority, but you're the baddest minority. So you're in charge. Just don't cause us any problems. The Sunnis turn around and say, hey, we're backing Germany. And they literally invited the Germans in. Now, the Germans at that time were in the Middle East. You know, they were in Greece and what have you, and the Germans started flying troops in to seal the deal, as it were. Well, the British cobbled together three divisions. They didn't have much manpower in 1940 in that area, and they did what literally the same thing we did in 2003. They invaded, and in 3 weeks they were in Baghdad, and they found another bunch of Sunnis who said, okay, no Nazis. And the British basically turned to that. And the Sunnis, in this case, they kept their word. I mean, they were still very much pro-Nazi, but they didn't make any alliances. They basically kept, you know, the Nazis from operating, as it were, in Iraq. And they didn't interfere with the oil coming out of Iraq for the Allied, you know, war movement. So all this stuff goes back a long time. And it's also, a lot of it is what goes around comes around. You still have a Sunni minority problem in Iraq. And as I point out in Strategy Page regularly, what a lot of Shia want to do is simply get rid of all of the Sunni minority. Now that, unfortunately, is a common solution in the Middle East. Now it's not politically correct. Technically it was never politically correct, but it's much more unpolitically correct these days to do that. And if they did it, the Saudis and the other Gulf Arabs, the UAE and what have you, will be under tremendous pressure to go to the aid of their friends. Now, they have a vested interest in doing this because they either go rescue the Sunnis in Iraq, meaning going to war with Iraq and Iran, because, well, you know how that connection works, or they basically absorb, you know, 4 or 5 million Iraqi Sunnis into their own population. That is still on the table. Nobody wants, it's the elephant in the room nobody wants to talk about. And that's how bad it can get.
Jim, I appreciate you saying what you said about the perceptions in 91 and 92 and, you know, reinforcing the point about what the deal the coalition had made. You shape it that the essential element, Washington, Riyadh, but there were plenty of other coalition members that signed on, and the only reason they signed on is because they wouldn't go after, you know, that requirement by the Saudis. Remember, the Egyptians showed up, and that Egyptian division actually did some fighting. They rounded up a couple of Iraqi divisions that were eager to surrender to an Arab force. There's some good reportage covering that Egyptian division. In other words, there was what the Bush administration, and this is Bush 1, did with that coalition was an extraordinary international political success, and a number of the members of the coalition that showed up, that made that political success, showed up because of the requirement that we're not going after Saddam. But Dan, as I've said, and I've told Jim about this before as well, because heck, Jim read the novel in draft when I finished it in 1999. Was my views on this have changed once I saw how many were killed. And the exacerbation of the already long-term sectarian division within Iraq, and the lesson, life lesson, is in 2004. I'm there, and I'm seeing that living with as a reality for American forces, but I'm witnessing it there because, heck, I'm on active duty and I'm serving as a plans officer in a multinational corps, the Shia distrust. And they keep going back, hey, what happened 13 years ago? What happened 13 years ago? Jim will point out here in a moment, well, everybody can come up with something that happened, you know, 400 years ago, and in the Middle East, it's not forgotten. No, it's not. But that was something we are still dealing with. It does not, however, legitimate Maliki's decision to be stupid, Dan, and he's done that. So, we've gone on for 45 minutes, guys.
Yeah. Let's wrap it up with just one last thing. Jim, where are the Kurds going to end up at the end of all of this?
At the moment, they have the strongest army, in local army, in the area, what they call the Peshmerga. And they are apparently waiting to see what we do. They may even be waiting on at our request, because they do basically cooperate with us a lot more than anybody else in that area does. But once the dust has settled, as it were, they've already got Kirkuk, and they're ready to take Mosul. They're ready to get their oil, all their oil back. By taking Kirkuk, they get a lot of oil. And of course, they not only would have the oil fields, but they have a way to get it out through Turkey. They also have demonstrated that they can protect their territory from Islamic terrorists who cannot get into. I mean, very few. There have been Sunni terrorist attacks in the Kurdish territory in the last 20 years. And a lot of them were a local group of Kurdish Islamic terrorists. That's rare among the Kurds. And they were wiped out. So the Kurds are definitely a force to be reckoned with. The Arabs despise them, in part because the Kurds are more capable. And again, historically, remember, the northern Iraq used to be part of the Turkish homeland. It was taken away from Turkey after it was the only part of the homeland as well, not the only part, there were a few other bits, but it was the most important part of the Turkish homeland that was taken away from Turkey after World War I when Turkey was on the wrong side. They were with the Germans. And given to the new country of Iraq. So it was an alien transplant. The Kurds didn't like being part of Turkey because they're basically Indo-European people, not Turks. But they liked even less being part of an Arab country because the Turks had a very famous phrase. I used to be able to say in Turkish, but can't anymore. Basically, don't involve yourself with the affairs of the Arabs. You know, nothing but trouble as far. And the Turks were running the place for 500 years. The Kurds are basically waiting to get their oil back. And the Turks, as far as they're concerned, they say, okay, they apparently have assured the Kurds that we are willing to recognize you, whatever, as an autonomous part of Iraq, as a separate country, whatever, you know, we can get past the UN or whatever, and do business with you as long as you do not support the ongoing Kurdish rebels in southeastern Turkey, and you basically, you know, play by some minimal rules, which so far the Kurds have been doing with the Turks. So they've been doing business with the Turks. And so the Kurds basically have northern Iraq, at least the important parts of northern Iraq, the parts of Nineveh province, that's where Mosul is, that have the oil. And ISIL will fight, no doubt, but they will lose. They've always lost to the Kurds. And I don't think the Kurds at this point, when they're going to get back all they've been trying to recover, you know, for the last 20 years, they're not going to give up. So the ugliness up there has not been completed yet.
Dan, let me suggest a topic out of that, because we'll come back to it. The Kurds were promised a Kurdistan in the Treaty of Sevres, which was a part of Versailles that dealt with the old Ottoman empire lands in the Middle East. And this is a major change in Turkish policy regarding a separate Kurdistan. The Turkey was against it. Turkey was for keeping Iraq together. And part of it, as Jim alluded to, was the ongoing Kurdistan Workers' Party insurgency in southeastern Turkey. But this would be a World War I topic with real relevance to current events. Maybe something we could pick up later in the summer.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you both, and we'll talk to you later.
Bye, guys.
Bye.